talent is such a like a misdirect. There are talented people who do amazing things, but it's not talent that gets you where you want to go. It's persistence. How many times have you been working on something and you hit that first roadblock, that first moment of doubt, and you're like, I should probably stop. This doesn't feel good. I am feeling insecure. I don't think this is going to be good. They're all going to laugh at me. If you can just keep going beyond that moment and the infinite subsequent moments of the similar feeling, you will make stuff and you will improve and you will have an opportunity to feel successful. And it works. It fucking works.
This is episode 14 of 1F Jeff.
The number 14 is the atomic number of silicon, essential to modern electronics, and in math, it's the smallest even number that isn't the sum of two primes. Historically, July 14 marks France's Bastille Day, while in religion, it's tied to the 14 stations of the cross and the 14 pieces of Osiris in Egyptian myth.
Hello, my friends. I'm still on the road, but I spent most of last week relaxing in the tiny house in San Jose. So I am releasing an interview this week as a break from my travel stories. I'm recording this back at my sister's place in San Francisco, and by the time this comes out, I'll be on my way back east with stops planned in Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Santa Fe, Colorado Springs. I am excited to get back on the road, not so much to get back to Ohio, but I'm excited to get back on the road. Today's guest is my friend, Alex Malice.
Alex Malice is a Brooklyn-based filmmaker whose work spans documentary and narrative, with films featured on PBS, Criterion, The New Yorker, and other major outlets. A member of the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective and Meerkat Media, his recent feature, The Travel Companion, co-directed with Travis Wood, premiered at the 2025 Tribeca Film Festival. He also co-directed the award-winning short, Shut Up and Paint, which was Oscar shortlisted and aired on PBS's POV.
I met Alex in the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective in about 2011. He's an extremely talented, prolific, and funny human being, and I was happy to hear that his feature film had been accepted into Tribeca, which is one of the most prestigious film festivals in the world, for those of you who are unaware. He shared a screener of the film with me before the interview, and it's a really great indie film with a lot of truth and connection and honesty. It's very much in the vein of this podcast in a way. This interview was recorded in mid-June, the day after the Tribeca Film Festival ended, and it also was before the New York City mayoral primary had been decided. We discussed both of these things in the episode, so if you can, while you're listening, please just close your eyes and imagine you're still enjoying those early days of summer in mid-June. If you're enjoying this podcast and listening to it on the regular, please do consider pitching in $5 a month or more to show your support on the Patreon page at patreon.com/1fjeff. In return for your generosity, you'll immediately get access to photos from my road trip and eventually get some extra content that nobody else will get. You'll be special, and you'll be able to say you were a supporter back in the days before everybody was a supporter. Back in the early days, before the show got all corporate and bullshitty. So please do that. And thank you again to all the current Patreon subscribers. You guys are the best. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram at 1fjeffpod. And you can email the podcast at 1fjeffpod@gmail.com. And you should. You should do both of these things. I really enjoyed this conversation with Alex. It's funny, it's engaging, it's introspective, and it's just good. So I hope you do enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Here's Alex Malice.
I feel like I've been drunk or inebriated or emotionally inebriated for like 2 weeks from this festival, so I'm just coming up for air.
Right. Did it just end?
It ended yesterday. Yeah, yesterday we had our last screening, and I slept about 12 hours last night. Feels good.
So tell us the story. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. As my uncle used to love to say, I was born at a very early age. Eh?
I get it. We can start back then. I'm happy to start back then. Yeah. I don't even know how you ended up in this world.
I don't have a lot of good memories prior to last week.
Well, we have to dig into that now. Actually,
we'll have to dig into that. No, yeah. Everything's been good. I've turned out all right. Yeah, I made my first feature film, co-directed, co-written, co-produced with a good friend of mine, and we had a third writer. And we made our first scripted narrative film, and we shot it last fall in November, and we kind of maybe broke some records here and actually got it to premiere at Tribeca last week.
Yeah, that's amazing. And for people who don't know, Tribeca is a big deal festival. It's a
big fucking deal
festival.
That's right.
Yeah, and how was that experience? Like, I mean, did you expect to get into Tribeca? How did you feel about the film after you were done with it?
I mean, it's a funny thing with film making because, like any art form, it's a personal, subjective experience where you sort of put your all into it, and in most cases you make something that you're quite proud of and you feel like is worthy to be seen or to be shared, and then you have to face this unfortunate moment, the gatekeeping moment where you have to, it's not a meritocracy. They're not saying, did you check all these boxes? Great, you're in. They say, do I like it or not? A group of people who, to be fair, have good taste, and especially after getting in, I'll say they have great taste, but it is subjective. You might have made a vampire film and they just hate vampire films, or you might have made maybe more appropriately, you might have made like a slow film and they hate that, or you might have made a more melodramatic film and they hate that, and even though it's quite good and maybe even audiences would like it or whatever. So what I'm trying to say is that you enter this moment, this unknown moment, where you, in one moment, you say, God damn, I've made, this is a Cannes winning, Oscar worthy film on my hands here.
Right, and then you get
a rejection and you say, holy, I'm a total failure.
Yeah.
The swing is great.
Yeah.
But we got lucky. Yeah, we got lucky, man. We finished the film, enough of the film. It was like kind of an advanced fine cut, not perfectly locked, but it was enough to submit. And we had one of the EPs in our film had a kind of a direct line to one of the programmers, which is don't tell,
that always helps. Yeah,
that always helps. And for your listeners, I want to say that doesn't mean you get in. That just means
it differentiates
you from the pile, because you imagine these programmers, the people make the selections, they get I guess they got like 15,000 submissions or something like that.
Jesus Christ.
They hire a whole team to kind of sift through it. And the stuff that actually makes it to the decision makers, the final decision maker, is a lot less. And so to have a person on the inside, able to sort of say, hey, look at this one.
Yeah.
That helped. And it helped a lot, because then we got in. We were overjoyed. I was on 14th Street in Manhattan screaming at the top of my lungs.
When you found out? You were on?
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes. Actually, no. I'll tell you where I was. I was in class. I was teaching an intro filmmaking class. And I happened to glance at my phone, which I shouldn't have done, and saw the good news and had to hold it in until I could get down to 14th Street, which is where I was screaming. We had a couple of drinks celebrating, because it's a huge moment. This is what I'm saying. There's all this unknown, all this anxiety, right? And it felt good.
You've been making films for how long now?
It depends what you call a film, but I think I've had a camera in my hands since like sixth grade or something.
Oh,
but,
no kidding.
Yeah. My parents bought a video camera, a home video. It was a VHS-C.
Uh-huh.
So it was like a miniature VHS tape. And I remember walking around the house on Christmas Day, I guess it would have been, just narrating as I pointed the camera at stuff.
Yep. Yep.
It was intuitive. I I'd never done it before, but I immediately fell in love with documenting. It sounds kind of cliche. It's like, oh, my God.
No, I totally get it. Yeah.
But I was like, God damn, I love this, or whatever, sixth grade me would have phrased it, but...
Yeah, no, I totally get that. When I was younger, we didn't have a video camera because I'm older and it was more expensive. But I carried around like a tape recorder and would like interview random people at like play practices and stuff. And then got a video camera and just videotaped everything. Back when you were allowed to videotape everything, because there was a period of time, I think it kind of stopped, but there was a period of time when you could have a camcorder and just shoot anything you wanted and nobody cared.
Yeah, it was kind of the sweet spot
yeah.
for documentarians, maybe like the 90s.
Yeah, before social media.
Before social media, when people's media literacy was sort of stunted or siloed, and people didn't quite make the connection that, oh, what's being,
yeah.
you know, my image is being captured and will be displayed and I want to have control over it. So it's kind of like, it's a kind of a funny irony, because it's like, well, we want people to understand those things, of course, but it sure makes it harder for us to go out and get stuff. Or
right, because there's a place to put it. There's a place to put it now, right? There's a place.
Yeah, there's a place to put it. Yeah. And people get it. When they see you with a camera, they say, oh, I actually have some level of understanding that this could end up in a place, you know, and seen by other people, and I wouldn't have control over it.
Right. It's like you have to be making a film now in order to get away with videotaping people randomly.
Yeah, people used to say, hey, what channel is this going to be on? Now they say, is this going to be on YouTube?
Right. Or Instagram or whatever it is.
Platform
of choice. Yeah, gotta help.
Yeah.
Well, congrats though, man. The film's great. I watched it. I just watched it actually. I really dug it, man. You've really captured something that was, I don't know. I appreciated the authentic feeling conversations that the men had. That I didn't feel like a lot of times in films I see with men are having conversations, it's about blah, 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 whatever, you know. But these were actually having meaningful conversations about important things. And I actually was like, oh, look at that. We're doing an important conversation with men kind of a thing. Like male friendship actually being, you know, sensitive and insightful in a way, which was refreshing, you know.
Well, thanks for saying that. That was definitely something that I, you know, I think all of us wanted. I can speak for myself. In saying that was important. I wanted, you know, I've seen a lot of films and I get taken out when the dialogue feels writerly or just sort of, it can really just take you out and you can get back in. But like, just for that moment, you're kind of like, ooh, you know, and I really wanted it to feel as natural and sort of conversational and as messy as conversations can be. And hopefully actually make it feel, like you said, appropriate that they're having these sort of bigger, quote unquote, conversations in a way that feels good.
Yeah, it did feel like somewhat improvised, but it felt improvised only to a point, because the conversations had a meaning often in the layer of the film, if that makes sense, you know?
It does.
Like, it wasn't just throwaway, you know, improvisational dialogue. There was profundity within there, which I really liked.
Yeah.
Was there any improv in it?
No, it's good. It's interesting to hear you say that, because I think that's spot on. It was scripted. You know, we had the whole thing scripted out. It was about 90 pages, which worked out. It was a 91-minute runtime, but there were definitely scenes that said they hang out together for the afternoon and hang out. Or they another one was there's another third character, a female character, and it was that starts a relationship with one of them, and the scene was they spend the afternoon together and like sort of fall in love. That's all we wrote. And so in those scenes, we really allowed for improv to happen. And I remember one scene where the two guys are sitting on a park bench just talking, and we would do these long takes. And we went up to them and would whisper in their ears things like, tell him what you're most what was this genius thing that my co-director came up with? It was like, tell me when you feel most afraid or most insecure. Tell him about that. I honestly forget the exact phrasing. I was like, holy shit, that's awesome. It was such a good prompt. So he was like, we're like, you know, use that. Talk about it as your character, this documentary filmmaker, but use it. And so we had to, you know, go back and forth, allowed them to go back and forth, and were able to cut it. But most of the good stuff we wrote. I don't want to discredit ourselves.
Dude, I'm not. I don't think that improvisation is discrediting. That's most of my films have been improvised, so I'm a big fan. What was I going to say? Oh, I also appreciated like the filmmaking. It was very much like there was a lot of insider filmmaking kind of humor in there, especially the film festival at the beginning, which had give me flashbacks, frankly, to film festival panels from
as
the past when you're all just standing there waiting for your chance to talk.
That was the first scene that we wrote, first and the last scene, which for your listeners takes place in the Q&A, the question and answer after a film is over. And something that I think, you know, you and I, Jeff, and certainly a lot of filmmakers have experienced is that awkward that awkward moment, a series of moments when you're standing up there under the hot light trying to answer questions, and usually the questions aren't that good.
No.
And
rarely.
And we just, I think it occurred, like, what, you know, not to spoil too much of the film, but we were just like, wouldn't it be funny if this character, who's this kind of like down and out, kind of abrasive, maybe a little bit annoying guy,
yeah,
who feels powerless. How do we show that? You know, they would say, like, you know, you should learn a lot about your character in the first scene. And we thought it would be funny if, after this long Q&A, he was denied the chance to speak, you know, due to time constraints.
Right. Well, you did make him kind of likable by the end, which was interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, it's good to hear. That was a big challenge. Is like, because I remember my buddy read the script and he was like, "Dude, like, what's your plan here? Because this guy just kind of sucks." You know, like, I don't know if I want to hang out with him. I said, "No, don't worry. Once you see it come to life, it's gonna work." And thankfully, our guy Tristan, our actor,
he was great. He
brought a humanity to it.
He did. I mean, it's also like, you know, it was hard to not like him because I think that a lot of men have been there. Like, it's, or even women, I'm sure. But like, with your closest friends, it's often different. You're often at your worst in a way. You're often like when you're so close with somebody, it's easy to not see the bullshit that you are sometimes, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
And he got to see it in a way that was unfortunate, you know. I was surprised you killed the baby off at the end, but I mean, that's your filmmaking decision. So,
sometimes I gotta go.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't want to have the Hollywood catharsis.
Yeah. No, I love any movie that ends with a dead baby. As you know, we've talked about this in the past. So
dead babies. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
No babies were harmed in the making of this film, but, we did early on sort of feel like, let's try and make this as honest as possible. Sort of what you were talking about earlier with some of the dialogue. We really just wanted to feel lived in and real. And the real thing that happens, I was hanging out with my friend the other day and I was like, "Hey, how's Kate?" And she's like, "Oh, I haven't really talked anymore." And she told me this, you know, long convoluted story that doesn't make sense to repeat now. But the point being that she had lost a friendship over an ambiguous sort of brewing resentment,
yep,
and whatever. And it was just like, and the way that story ends is that they're not friends anymore, end of sentence. And
yeah,
it's like, right, they didn't have some kind of like epiphany at the cupcake store where they saw each other across the way and were like, "Hey, old friend, let's give it another go." That's just not how life is.
No, I've lost friends in that same way, and it's just, yeah, it's hard for me to, it's, I struggle with it because I'm, if anything, a loyal friend, and I just don't understand how people can walk away. Because life is, this is it, I think, right? So why would you ever dismiss, anyway?
Well, I think it sounds like you picked up on it a little bit. We wanted to kind of play with this idea of old friendships that are held together, you know, with a scotch tape after all these years. And it's sort of the momentum that keeps you friends. It's the... not so, you know, maybe your interests have differed, your temperament has differed,
yep,
your sort of life philosophy is different, but you're still friends because you have that, you know, you had the same homeroom teacher in the sixth grade, and
right,
that's like,
right,
something you can go back to. But like, is that enough to sustain a friendship? Sometimes it just takes, it's the wind blowing the wrong way, and you sort of realize, wait a minute, this isn't working.
Right, right, right. So how was the experience of Tribeca? Like, it's got to be a, you know, kind of overwhelming experience to suddenly be on the inside there, you know?
Yeah, it's overwhelming. It's quite fun. You know, filmmaking is a solitary, grueling,
sure,
thankless practice. And this is your one chance.
Yeah.
This is a big moment.
Yeah.
To sort of,
yeah,
celebrate and be celebrated and screen with a, you know, we sold out all the shows. So there's
awesome,
you know, auditoriums filled with people clapping, laughing, whatever. And the Q&As, of course, were interesting, and talking to people after, and, you know, having parties and just like really feeling like things make sense for just a minute. Like, hey, this was worth it. This is great.
Right. The path seems like it was the right path for
sure.
Yeah.
At least that's what everyone's telling you in that moment.
Yeah. 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 But then the bar just gets higher, right?
Yeah. The bar does get higher. That has been the biggest, that's the ongoing challenge for certainly for artists. And I think kind of for everybody,
uh-huh,
it's this existential crisis that we're all forced to face in this hyper-capitalist world of just like, what does success look like? and when am I there?
And also that, like, human nature is just to always want something more, right? You know, you get into one thing and then you want the higher thing. You want the higher thing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just being satisfied with what we have in front of us is difficult.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're set up, you know, if it's not growth, it's not working. You know, if you're not constantly on to the next, it's not good enough. That's kind of what we're indirectly told. So, but this was a moment, I think, to really just, like, shut those voices up and enjoy it. And, you know, met a lot of people, got a lot of great feedback.
Sure.
You know, like I said earlier, it's been a pretty quick turnaround. We shot it in the fall.
Yeah,
and now
yeah,
it's
yeah.
June and we're premiering it. So it just feels like, oh, we're cruising here. This is great.
Yeah. No. How long was the shoot?
15 days.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. Because it was, like,
yeah.
amazing New York film. Like, the shots, it was like watching a Woody Allen film from the 70s.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, we were inspired by him. Well, by his imagery, anyway.
Yeah, it was like you found the Woody Allen shot, but then you found a different place to do it. And I was like, oh, I haven't seen that angle before. Yeah, that was good.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah, we definitely, that was the reference image, was the Manhattan.
Yeah, I caught that one. It was a different shot of it, but it was the same.
It's a different bridge. The bridge in his is the Queensboro Bridge.
Oh, right, right.
We were using the Manhattan Bridge, but that's a sweet spot for sure.
Yeah. So anything, what happens after Tribeca? What happens now?
Everybody goes home and never speaks to me again.
All right. Well, that's fun. So,
we have a couple of festivals upcoming. And then we're kind of on this extremely steep, rungless ladder of trying to get distribution.
Yeah.
We've just been told time and time again, hey, if you don't have a celebrity, if it's not a genre film, if it's not horror,
yeah.
They're not buying it.
Yep.
And, so far that's proven to be true, but it's early. We're still hopeful. I think the independent, no actor film world is like a rotting corpse on the side of the road.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, maybe we could be vultures. Or what was the joke we were making? We're like, we're gonna be the last helicopter out of Saigon. So yes, things are changing.
A little Vietnam War
for the. For the older listeners,
who's going to be the monk that burns himself? Who's going to be that one?
Right. Yeah. Hopefully not me. But yeah, we're hopeful. So we'll see. We'll see. It's a lot of we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be available in some way at some point.
So here's a question: did you enjoy the making of the thing? Because the idea for this podcast is, in many ways, like, I realized the last thing I made was a while back, film wise, that adult series, and I realized when it didn't get much traction afterwards. You know, you're always thinking about what this is going to do for me, right? In a way, you're thinking about who's going to see it, what festivals is it going to get into, so forth and so on. Which I realized with that project, I was like, no, the joy has to come from the work itself, right? It has to come from the making of the thing itself. And the rest, you know, as much as possible is gravy, right? So the impetus for this was very much to be like, well, I just kind of want to have connections and conversations with people, some that I don't know, some that I haven't talked to in years, like you. And then I'll put it on the internet. And if people want to listen to it, they listen to it. But for me, the satisfaction just comes from the doing of the thing itself.
Absolutely. No, I mean, you hit the bullseye on that. I think we actually, that was one of our very first sort of tenets that we set up, the rules, if you will, of making this film, is it had to be fun.
I love that.
And we didn't want to wait for anybody. So it was kind of like, it has to be fun to make. It has to be honest and nothing can stop us. That was like this three rules that we set up for ourselves. So whether it was writing, fundraising, even certainly production. I mean, production was a blast. We had an amazing team. We had had so much fun. Everybody was working together. It was this little utopic moment.
Love it.
Post-production, the festival, it's all just been like so fun. So even if it all ended now, even if the music stopped, I wouldn't be that bitter, at least knowing that it was a hell of a ride.
That bitter.
A little bitter.
A little bit. But yeah. Well, that's good, because then, you know, if you have fun making the thing and then Tribeca happens, then, I mean, you've really got a piece of, like, that's just magic right there, right? That's already.
It's all icing at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, congrats. That's honestly, it couldn't happen to a better guy. I haven't seen you for years,
Thank you.
It was always a fan of yours when we were in BFC together.
Likewise.
By the way, the BFC website, the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collection website link on your website, goes to an Indonesian gambling site at present. Just wanted to give you a heads up.
Really?
Yeah. Just wanted to let you know. Just wanted to let you know that that's what's going on there.
And you're saying that's a bad thing?
No, it could be a good thing. I didn't know if you guys had changed. I thought maybe the BFC had changed into something else that I hadn't been aware of. I've been out of the loop for a while, so maybe that's what you guys are into now.
Wow. Amazing
gambling. Yeah. And
I'm on it now.
There's money in
this
that,
too. This is incredible.
Thank God I'm here.
This is a pretty active blog here.
Yeah.
My goodness.
I don't know how you guys are keeping up with anything without me there, to check the website links.
Yeah, maybe we should do this more regularly.
Sure. Yeah, no kidding. So would you say this is the best thing that's happened in your career so far?
That's a tough one.
You've been doing professional filmmaking. Like, as a professional, you've been doing it for how long now?
As a professional, I would say I've really been doing it since maybe like 2011.
Okay.
So that was when I first got into a film festival and was like, oh,
yeah,
maybe this is where it's at. So yeah, that was good. I mean, this was incredible. I think I don't want to compare. I guess I had another kind of like pretty decent success not so long ago with a short film that was Oscar shortlisted.
Oh, which one's that?
It's called Shut Up and Paint.
Oh yeah, I saw that. That was great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like I think for my career, it's tough to say. I don't know. I don't fucking know. It was crazy just to like campaign and like meet all these people and sort of start to get closer to Hollywood, which felt like honestly, the absolute best metaphor for an Oscar is Lord of the Rings, in that you have this ring of power,
yeah,
and you're like getting closer to Mordor, and the closer you get, the more like corrupt and insane you feel.
Yeah.
And then when you lose the ring, all you want to do is bite off your best friend's hand. That's the Gollum reference there. Yeah. So that was crazy. We got pretty far. We did not get nominated though.
Right.
Semi-final or whatever, semi-finalists.
I was in the Oscar, that Sundance film like 15 years ago, and that I think automatically gets you somehow, but I never.
You're probably qualified, yeah.
Yeah, something like that, but that didn't. You know, obviously, I wasn't in the Oscars, so because I wouldn't probably be doing the podcast if I gotten in the Oscars. Maybe I would
maybe
be.
Not.
Who knows? Who knows?
Maybe
who knows what
would.
The path?
Who knows, yeah.
What the path becomes, right?
Exactly.
So, what else has been going on? I mean, aside from, I guess you've been probably swamped and kind of like ass deep in the film for the last like 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, that's kind of it for the last bit. And I've got a bunch of other smaller projects I'm working on, some short docs and a feature doc that I'm trying to get into post-production, and I teach at Hunter College.
Okay.
I DJ a lot. That's kind of my...
Yeah, no, you're still doing all the DJing.
My thing, yeah. I really like that.
Yeah, yeah. You're still doing the... and making any fart NFTs anymore, or is that...
No, that was a one time only. You know, I would have loved to. I actually saw Tim Heidecker at the festival.
Oh, did you really?
To him. Yeah, and I was like, hey, you know, I'm a fan, because I just see him in a film. I was like, how you doing? And I was about to tell him, hey, do you remember I was on your podcast? I'm the guy who sold the farts. And he, but right before I said that, he was accosted by a fan. And honestly, it was for the better. I think it would have been sort of humiliating.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize you were on his, I knew you were on an Irish radio show that actually it was turning COVID.
That was more significant.
Yeah.
To be honest, I was on the second most listened to radio station in all of Northern Ireland. So,
yeah. And that was a long interview too, from what I recall.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was a really funny interview because we first talked very philosophically about like he was bringing up all these like interesting philosophical metaphors, like the ship of Theseus, and and then at the end he just played the farts.
Yeah.
So it was like an amazing trajectory.
So for people who don't know, can you rehash the story of the fart NFT COVID
shit.
Thing?
That was a ride. Well, the you know, honest to God, embarrassing origin is that me and my friends had a WhatsApp group, and we were and plug your ears, listeners, we were sending our farts to each other.
Alex, there's nothing embarrassing about this at all. This is one of the funniest things that I've ever. I still think about how genius this whole thing was. But keep going. I was go ahead.
Yeah, so we we're recording and sending our farts around. We're doing it for quite a while. And
how long were you doing it for? How long this was going for?
We ultimately did it for an entire calendar year.
Wow. How much? So you got what, 365? Farts or every day?
Well, it wasn't every day. Sometimes there would be a cluster, and then maybe a week would go by, and it would be sort of sad and silent, and then things would perk up again.
Who started it? Was it you or the other person?
The actual, you know, the initial fart. That's a great question. Yeah, I have to go back and look.
Thanks.
That's one for the.
And you don't remember? That's interesting. I would be proud if I was the one who was. I would know. I'd be like, yeah, I was the one who did the first. Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah, fart humor has been a part of my life, you know, forever.
Oh,
so
never goes away.
When did it? Never goes away. So anyway, we had this collection, and we were the pandemic hit. We were all sitting around, fucking, and right around the time the pandemic, it was like the perfect storm. If you know, we all remember NFTs and crypto. It's because everybody was in front of their computer all day long, and so something as stupid as NFTs, it was like the perfect the circumstances for them to take off. And we were watching them, and we saw that you know, some of these were selling for absolutely millions.
Yeah.
And I don't remember. It was my idea. I'm gonna go, if the other guys who helped out are listening, I'm sorry. It was my idea to turn it into an NFT.
Genius.
And we thought, so the original thought was like just a send up. And so we ended up using OpenSea, which is sort of like the eBay of NFTs.
Right.
You know, we made these, I found like a web 1.0 GIF generator and made a bunch of really ugly, stupid looking GIFs that just said the word fart and then a random number that I picked, like fart number 2041.
How many were there? Do you know how many farts there were?
In total, I don't, but we sold a random amount. So okay. We were also trying to sort of like make fun of the scarcity, the artificial scarcity that was a big part of NFTs.
Right.
Like 1 of 10 or 1 of 20, unique, blah, blah, blah. And so we had these sort of random exclusive seeming numbers. And we made a website. And then what we did is we posted to Reddit and that like, hey, like I'm selling farts. And then we bought upvotes. We bought like 1,000 upvotes.
Oh, you can buy upvotes on Reddit?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good to know.
We bought like we bought a bunch of upvotes, so it put it to the front of the NFT subreddit, and then somebody bought one. Somebody bought a fucking NFT. And we're like, I can't believe it happened.
How much did they buy it for?
At the time, it was around $85.
Wow.
Of Ethereum. So it wasn't cash. It was crypto. But it was real crypto in my wallet. And then we activated our network, so to speak. And I had a friend who had a friend who had a friend who's an editor at the New York Post. And this is exactly the kind of shit they were looking for. And so next thing I knew, I was doing a video interview with a young writer, and she wrote this amazing piece, Anna Frisberg, about us. And it sort of, I think the reason it took off was because everybody hated this NFT thing, but couldn't quite put their finger on why, couldn't quite articulate why, what I mean?
Yeah,
and it was
sure.
Just like, all right, this is it. So like, and especially conservative media, because it feels like sort of an elitist sort of endeavor, this like art elite crossover. And I think the New York Post and the Fox Newses of the world, like just fucking loved
of course.
It. So they ran with it and we went crazy. It was the most viral I've ever gone. We were getting hit up, you know, I was on Kiss FM in Canada, I was on Irish radio, Tim Heidecker.
Now, as you know, people will buy anything. The latest craze for so-called non-fungible tokens involves people paying huge amounts of money for what are basically fancy gifts. So Alex Ramirez Malas has taken this idea one stage further by selling a year's worth of audio recordings of farts. Alex joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Alex.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Just so people know, are these just your own farts, Alex, or a group of farts from different people?
That's a great question. So it's a collection of a year's worth of farts that were compiled by 5 different artists.
You started doing, as I understand, you started doing this a year ago. Why did you start recording your own farts a year ago?
Well, a year ago on March 12th was when we started that, roughly coincided with the beginning of the U.S. lockdown, sort of the beginning of quarantine. And so we were trying to find ways to connect, you know, make each other laugh, make each other happy. And didn't take long before somebody sent across a fart to the chain and kind of took on its own life from there.
Right. Okay. And was it like a competitive farting situation?
Not really. You know, it's not really a winning and losing game farting. It's really kind of an everyone wins kind of situation.
And we ended up selling around 10.
Oh, so you made what? How much money did you make on this?
I think around like $1,000.
Wow.
At the time, which we immediately used to buy drugs on the black market. So I don't actually have that money.
Wow.
Anymore.
What kind of drugs did you? What kind of drugs did you buy?
Cough syrup for a local hospital that was in need. I'm kidding. We bought cocaine.
Oh, all right, great. Yeah, was it good?
No.
Oh, really?
It was fine. Yeah. It wasn't like I was like, hell yeah, we're gonna, you know, because when you buy it online, it sort of looks like the sites you're buying it from also look like eBay.
Yeah, no, I've been on these. They're crazy. Yeah.
You've been on these things, yeah. Right? And you're like, you know, 100% quality fish scale, straight from Colombia, blah blah blah. And you're like, ooh, and you're kind of like browsing the market. And then we bought one, and it worked.
Right, but it wasn't like the best you've ever.
It wasn't like I imagine it was in 1979 or whatever. Code was. Amazing.
Right. It's funny because I remember being on those sites and it was like Amazon. There were star ratings and everything for the vendors and stuff.
Exactly.
So I assume that the vendors with the big star ratings have got the best stuff. But I guess in this case, no. But I've only bought like DMT and Ecstasy and stuff from those sites. And that was always good. That was always good.
It was fine. We weren't ripped off. It just wasn't like amazing.
Right. Well, I mean, it's great that you made money selling your farts and then bought cocaine with that. That's even better, actually.
Out one hole in another, as they say.
You've had that joke for a while, I assume.
No, actually, that's the first time.
Well done. Yeah, that's a solid.
Talked about my cocaine purchases. Normally, that doesn't come up.
Oh well, yeah, this is what happens. There's actually been a lot of talk of drugs in these interviews so far. Weirdly enough,
is that right?
So you're not the first. Double orifice joke is. I think that's the first.
That's the first. Sure. I feel good about that. I might recycle that.
Yeah, no, that's good stuff. I was proud to. I mean, I'm proud to know you now, of course. But back then, I was like during COVID, everybody was in house. I was proud to know. I was like, that guy. I know the guy who's selling his farts.
Yeah, it was a pretty iconic moment for me.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Some people were coming out of the woodwork, like from high school, and just people I had not heard of in years who were like, "Holy shit, I saw this! Like, what's up?" And it was fun to, but it was also sort of surreal to be like, "Okay, and what they're hitting me up peak." The reason they're hitting me up, you know?
Right. During COVID, I had a thing that blew up randomly, but it wasn't as good as a fart thing. But it was the same kind of thing where people were coming out of the woodwork to message me. It was that, you remember this Trump video? That was the Lincoln Project for years.
Oh, yeah. I remember
and
that.
And I did that Regeneron video that blew up. And boy,
yes,
people were coming out of the woodwork for that one.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Enjoy
Weird
it.
Times. Weird times. Yeah. But and it worked because we got him. He's not in the president anymore, I don't think.
Yeah, I think I haven't heard that name. I don't think anyone's even spoken his name now.
No, I don't think so either. I think that, I don't even know who the president is now, but it's not him. Yeah. So looking back, like, do you think that there's a point in your life, a moment in your childhood, in your teenager years, in college, whatever it was, where you were like, oh, my life shifted here for the better?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the first one that comes to mind would be in college, freshman year, like the first week of school. I'm in the dorms and there's a dude out front. Our dorm faced the little quad thing, and this guy was skateboarding out front. And I was skateboarding, and I was into skateboarding, so I just went down and hung out, introduced myself to him, and it turns out he was similar to me in that he filmed himself and his friends skateboarding growing up, you know, in high school and whatnot. And he was like, I'm going to go check out the student AV club at the school, University of New Hampshire.
Right.
And I was like, okay, you know, I liked it. We were instant friends. And I said, I'm down. Let's go check it out. And I got super involved. Ended up spending all my time there. Got my 10,000 hours in, as they say, just like fucking around, making awful, unwatchable content. But if I wasn't in class and I wasn't sleeping, I was in this in the studio that we had, messing around with cameras, editing, learning, making tons of mistakes. And I think that was pivotal for
sure.
Me. That was a point where I really just like made all the mistakes, although obviously I continued to make many, but I made a lot back then and got like a confidence, a DIY confidence. Like I can figure this out. I can learn this. I can solve this when it comes to filmmaking and art making. And I really kind of like found my voice, or at least maybe I didn't find my voice, but I found a path that made sense. And I pivoted away from science, which is what I was studying, and started.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah,
What kind of science?
Environmental science, like
natural
resource management, stuff like that. I thought I wanted to maybe be an environmental lawyer or
something. I could not see you as a lawyer. I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah.
So I made the right move and kind of pivoted and ended up heading towards New York City and media and filmmaking.
Interrupting briefly to let you know that the podcast now has a Patreon page. You can sign up to donate a small amount each month to support 1F Jeff, the podcast. There are perks to thank you for your generosity, and more will be added as Jeff thinks of them. I'm an AI assistant, so I don't have human feelings, but if I did, I probably wouldn't like Jeff, though I would absolutely love this podcast. And if I had money, I'd give as much as I could. So please head to patreon.com/1fjeff to sign up. That's patreon.com/1fjeff. Okay, back to the show.
Yeah, when I was going to go to film school, I was living in South Korea teaching English at the time. And I knew I needed to leave South Korea because I've been there for 2 years, and there was a lot of old people there who had been teaching for years, and it was just sad. So I was like, I always liked editing and making films and documenting. That was a big part of my past. But I was also like suddenly interested in the Middle East because my girlfriend at the time was living there, and I had visited Israel, and I was just interested in the politics. So I was like, well, I'll either go into Middle Eastern studies or filmmaking. And God bless America, I ended up going into filmmaking in spite of the student loan debt that I still have.
Oh God, still.
Have
you tried getting rich?
Yeah, that's the podcast time. I'm waiting for the money to roll in, Alex.
Nice.
Because these things are money makers. I don't know if you know this. This is just, I'm already looking for houses.
Yeah, my uncle was saying, you should start a podcast. I hear there's a lot of money in that. He doesn't send anything like that, but I'm glad to see you're doing it.
I've been meaning to do this for years, and I got laid off in January. And I haven't done anything creative for creative's good for a while because I've been in politics, and it's a soul-sucking industry, and yada, yada, yada.
That's a bummer about getting laid off because it's so close to being something amazing. You know, like I got laid.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. I thought you meant the Lincoln Project itself, which wasn't on the way. It was just becoming more of a growth.
I'm just thinking for the first half of that statement, I'm like, oh, what's to be upset about? And then when you drop that final word, it all sort of falls into place. Yeah.
No, laid off. But it was for good because I don't want to be in politics. I mean, 4.5 years in politics, it was too much.
Is that how long you were there?
Yeah, no kid. It was, I mean, honestly, who would have thought? I never even intended to get into politics, and it just kind of like randomly fell in my lap. And I was supposed to be there for 3 months, and then they just kept extending my contract, and then they gave me a full-time contract, then they gave me a raise, and I was making decent money.
Can you drop some numbers?
I was making six figures.
That's great. I've never made six figures before one day.
Yeah, you find that, you know, I had a lot of debt to pay off, and I still do, but and I live in Columbus, Ohio, so it's not very expensive. I mean, where does $100,000 a year get you in New York City anymore? I don't even know if I could live there.
You can get a monthly train pass. Maybe a membership to BAM.
I miss New York sometimes, but not too often. I visited once. We almost tried to get together that one time the last time I was there a couple years ago.
But,
and I did. I loved visiting it, but then it started getting hot, and that city just like holds humidity it just really holds humidity in so well that it makes me just sweat everywhere I go.
It's true.
And it really, I don't like to be sweaty. That's why I left.
Is it better in Columbus?
No, but you don't really have to, like New York City, you're kind of forced to, you know, in a good way, you're walking
you
and you
outside.
Have to be outside, and you're walking all over, you're schwitzing. What's the word? Schwitzing? Schwitz?
That's right.
Schwitzing. Schwitzing, yeah. All over the city.
Oh, you really do need to come back here. We got to get your Yiddish shored up.
Yeah. It was never that good when I was there, and I'm not Jewish, although everybody continued to insist. Boy, when I was in New York, those people who would stand in the street and during like Passover or whatever, and they would like go up to people who they thought were Jewish to do the thing. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But they would always. And one time I was like, I'm not Jewish. And the guy's like, really? I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not.
That's
not
good.
Jewish, but, you know, it worked out in a way.
Yeah, they're still out there. They're pretty liberal with their with the net they cast. I've seen them approach some of the more waspy looking people in the world and you know, like a Irish Catholic looking redhead. Are you Jewish?
I'm not. Are you?
I am Jewish.
Are you really? Oh, yeah. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm half. My dad's Jewish. My mom's not. My mom's Cuban.
Oh, okay. That's what because that's the look. You kind of have more of a Cuban look than.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah. When you see my dad, actually, you'll be like, oh, that guy looks exactly the same. But
right.
I mean, it's a mix, 50%.
Huh. But your mom is Jewish, so you're Jewish.
I am Jewish.
Huh. Do you practice?
No, wait. Sorry. That's backwards. My dad is Jewish,
okay.
So I'm not Jewish.
Okay.
So technically, you know, the rabbi, depending on which sect you go to, they either let me in or
did
not.
You do the thing? Do you do the thing?
They did mutilate my genitals, if that's
oh,
what
they did
asking.
That to me too, but I'm not, I mean, that's what they did back then. Yeah,
that was a way. No, I don't practice, although I have lately been feeling a lot more Jewish than I ever have.
Huh, what do you?
And I guess I mean, like, it's a function of being in New York.
Yeah.
There's just Jews everywhere, right. And it's like you forget Jews make up like 0.01% of the population of the world. Like, they're not that
many. No, but there's a ton in New York.
But New York, they're here, so you sort of forget. and you start to feel, you feel the energy. But also, I just think, and hopefully this doesn't take too much of a turn here, but just this moment, this political moment where Jewishness and anti-Semitism is being leveraged in ways that I find disgusting. Yep. I feel like, hey, I'm also Jewish, and this is how I feel. I feel different. I feel critical. I feel nuanced, and I just want to like sort of wear that loud and proud. And so in that sense, I've actually been almost, I've been more interested in, and not just like Jewish identity, but also just like Judaism. I'm like, should I, you know, I actually went to temple. Granted, it was a Park Slope radical, you know, the rabbi was trans, that kind of vibe, but it was, you know, it was a bunch of Jews nonetheless. And I was like, hell yeah, this is important to me, because I do have a lot of Jewish friends, and a lot of them, you know, other, I'm exposed to a lot of Jewish networks, and some of them I can sort of see, I'm like, oh, there's like this whole sort of looming Zionism, like extremely close to me. And I just want to, I want to be something else.
Yeah.
So that, because it's frustrating to see how Zionism is corrupting the world's perspective of what of the diversity of Jewishness and the sort of plurality of Jewishness.
Well, the voices, the voices of reason are being kind of muffled out in favor of the voices of the continued slaughter of, you know, brown people.
Yeah. Wait, what are they doing?
Yeah, there was a thing going on. Do you know what's going on out there? There's a whole thing.
I have no idea.
Yeah, there's this whole thing going on with that area. I think Trump's going to make it into a casino or something, so they'll like that because they got money to blow.
Trump's going to make it a casino, beachfront property led by Jared Kushner. I know, it's just been like, it's been sickening, and I think I felt a frustration, like a deep, real frustration, like capital F, at seeing Jewishness be conflated with ethno-nationalism or whatever, and that that sucks. And I just feel like I've actually, you know, not lost sleep, but like I just feel anxious about it in a way that I've never felt about things in the past in this way.
Right, and almost in the same way that like any kind of outspoken person against what Israel's doing is kind of labeled anti-Semitic and kind of thrown under the bus. Some of them certainly are anti-Semitic, and not to say that that doesn't go on, but like it is a thing that's being thrown around pretty liberally just to kind of quell the protesting voices in the
right world. Yeah, it's the greatest irony of this moment, of course. Well, there's a lot of tragedy, but one of the great ironies is that in this quest to so-called quest to make Jews safer, it's making us all so much less safe. Yeah. You know, anti-Semitism is so real. It's so real. I mean, there was this, I was reading about this thing the other day. It's the Holocaust. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, no, I went to this museum. Yeah, it was a whole thing.
Right. Was it the MoMA?
No, it was the Holocaust Museum, I think it was called.
Apparently it was worthy of making a museum. I mean, it's just like this stuff is so real, and it's growing and it's getting worse, and it's just frustrating to, sorry to infuse jokes into this.
No,
but,
it's all go.
It's a tough moment to feel like everything is going in the wrong direction.
Well, it becomes self-perpetuating in a way, because like anti-Semitism, you're not quelling the anti-Semitism by doing this, Israel. You know, and the government of Israel is not doing anything to help anti-Semitism by indiscriminately bombing brown people.
That's right.
So you could make people probably less anti-Semitic if you were like to say, well, maybe we shouldn't be bombing all the people, or, you know, maybe we should. But
anything.
But
else.
it's the horrible governments. It's always.
Well, we got a little. We have some a positive twist on the moment right now is that in New York City, at least, we have these two mayoral candidates, Zohran Mamdani and Brad Lander, who are two progressive leaders. Brad Lander has a little more of a name for himself, but this guy Zohran's coming like out of nowhere, just total taking the city by storm. He's Muslim.
Oh,
Brad Lander's Jewish, and they just cross endorsed each other like a couple of days ago and released a campaign video that was like, yeah, we know, because it's ranked voting in New York, which is you can sort of vote for more than one person, and so it's just like this little blip, little drop in the bucket of unity, and it's like, it's just so wild to have any interaction with politicians that doesn't make you want to blow your fucking brains out.
No, it's really, don't even get me started. Do you think he'll actually get a good mayor out of this one? Do you think he'll actually finally break the streak of?
Well, once again, it's between like somebody pretty good and like the absolute worst fucking asshole of all time.
Cuomo,
I think namely Andrew
Cuomo.
Andrew,
yeah,
Cuomo.
It's amazing that he's actually doing it again. It's like, dude, the cojones on this. Like, the cojones on that guy.
Yeah. I know, and that it's working. It's just like, god damn it. But Zohran, his primary challenger, has been creeping up, and at least in the latest poll, surpassed him. So we shall see. But there's this crazy thing, and I'm probably start talking a little outside my wheelhouse, but I've just been hearing like the sort of cynical hot takes that like somebody like Zohran or even Brad Land are these like ultra progressives who have this sort of socialist vision. If they get elected to lead New York City, everyone, those in power, you know, the elites, certainly the Republican establishment, is going to do everything that they can to make sure they fail.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Sure. Like, to make a point, which is just sort of an awful idea to contend with. And just today, the New York Times editorial board came out with an editorial dissuading people.
Of course.
Saying this guy's, he's too radical. He's too progressive. He doesn't have any good ideas, and nothing will get done. We need somebody like Bloomberg. And it's just like, what the
fuck? You get corporate interests involved, and they, you know, talk to their people at the New York Times, and then they get things to go their way. You know, this is how...
You just, like, you want to look to the... I have, like, such a love-hate with the press, because, like, people shit-talk the New York Times. I'm like, no, like, that's actually all we have. Like, we need to protect the press. And then they do shit like this, and you're like, burn these fuckers to the ground. You know, I metaphorically, I don't actually want them to go away, but... It's just like, who do we look to?
Yeah.
It's such a funny moment because there is some truth to this like popular reporting style, I think. But then when that gets conflated with that as like a full on replacement and when there's no fact checking, you know, like anyone with a platform, anyone with a podcast, you know, no one's going to fact check this.
We have actually a pretty solid team of fact checkers.
A pretty robust team. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, it's just a funny moment for press and sort of like, who am I putting my weight behind? Who do I believe in to tell the story?
And I feel like when you get, you know, they've always been about, you know, the press has always wanted to make money. But now, I mean, I think this goes with kind of everything in the world. The internet has really turned monetization into a targeted algorithm that is hard to compete with. So, you know, you're always fighting for clicks, and you know, fear and anger and whatever, those are the things that get clicks. That's how you make your money. That's an article about, you know, true joy is not going to get you a bunch of clicks. It's not going to
You know what does, though? An article about farts.
Yeah, see, there's the thing. That's what you should be.
I think honestly, to go back, I think that's one of the main reasons that beyond the just implicit hilarity of farts, that was one of the things that added such fuel to the fire of that moment, that viral moment, was like, the world was fucking on lockdown, and there was like misinformation was going fucking crazy, you know, skeptics and just like anti-government, whatever was going nuts. So we were all feeling psycho. And then it was like, wait, I can click on this article about a guy who sold farts.
Right.
It was, you know, an article about joy. And I think it really caught fire.
Yeah. And farts is one of the only things, like, comedy doesn't age well, generally speaking, but farts, it's one of those consistent, like, it never ends with farts. Farts are always funny.
Yeah. They're always funny. I found myself, you know, one night during that, that whole sort of whirlwind of a moment, I found myself Googling, why are farts funny? History of funny farts. When did farts become funny? And I was honestly not really getting any good answers. Huh. They should add that to the list of questions, you know, unanswered, the great philosophical questions of our humanity.
I feel like there could be a fart documentary at this point. I mean, has somebody done that yet? Because that's
I tried to make one.
Oh, really?
Sort of. I made a pitch video, and I only pitched it one place, and they're like, they kind of just ignored me. I wanted to do a takedown of NFTs, because I actually went to this NFT conference.
Oh, did you really?
A bunch of unused footage here in New York, and a lot of the crypto celebrities were there, and it was such a psychotic pageant that everybody was in on. And I remember being in line, we were doing like line interviews with people, and it's such good footage. I'm still sort of one of those projects I'm mad that I didn't sort of just like will into existence. But we were out there, and the dichotomy was like shattering. It was, the first person would be like, yeah, you know, I'm just excited to get to go in. I can't wait to see all the cool art, and just like, you know, crypto, it just feels like this this like utopian vision of the future. You know, we don't need banks. We don't need this. Right. And they're, you know, that's a very utopian take. And they were really sort of doe eyed about it.
Yeah.
And they would go in. Next person. Yeah, my buddy, he told me to buy one of these like ape things. So I bought one. Boom. Things now it's worth, you know, $1 million. That's crazy. Like, that's crazy. And that's like, that was his take, you know, and he go. And it was just like back to the next person. It was like a crypto techno utopia. It's the next person is just like, get rich quick. And if that little 30 minutes we spent outside didn't sort of sum it all up perfectly, I don't know what does.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of one of that. What's the guy who was all gas, no brakes, was Channel 5 now, that guy?
Yeah. Andrew Callahan.
He went to like a Flat Earth conference years ago, and it was just solid gold in the sense that like that was my favorite conspiracy of all time. I mean, if you're talking about conspiracies, so the Flat Earth thing, you're basically saying nothing's real at that point. You're just done. Like if you're, yeah. And like I dug into that a bit because I was so fascinated with how people could truly believe and think some of them really did that the earth was flat, and the I like dug into the actual idea of it. There's like a ice wall. I don't know how much you know about it, but their idea is
I know a fair amount.
It's flat and there's an ice wall, and like the firmament is part of it. That's part of the thing, and there's a firmament in the sky. Yeah, so I'm actually a flat earther now. That's I looked into
is that,
it.
This is, that's yeah, kind no, of where this is all roads lead to flat earth.
Yeah, it's actually a flat earth documentary. We turn it about 58 minutes and then we start talking about flat earth theories and
that sounds fine.
Yeah, no, I know. That should be a movie too. Is it? They probably made. They did make a flat Earth documentary where they at the very end. Did you see it? Where they did the test?
Yeah, I did. I think I saw just the clip where they do the laser or the light thing with the different. Yeah. And the guy's like, "Huh, I guess the world is round." And then the credits roll.
Right, the
like,
end.
Yeah, it kind of was the end, wasn't it?
It kind of was. Yeah, that was the end. Yeah.
I always found it to be sort of like edgelord, just like a way of like an incel sort of like attention community thing. I'm
yeah.
Like, do you guys really believe this or is it just sort of like an indignance?
I mean, I got on some chat rooms. I'm not proud to say this, but I did at one point get on some chat rooms with these people. And like some of the ones I interacted with genuinely seemed to be trying to convince me that this was true. Like there was not like a joking element to it. They were like showing me websites and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah. So I don't know if that's better or worse than having it be a joke. I kind of want it to, I kind of want it to be both because I want to know that there's people out there who truly believe that the earth is flat because that just makes me feel, I guess, better about the universe in some really weird way.
Let's hope the earth is flat. That's the position I'm taking.
So you dating anybody these days?
Yeah, still with my partner, Dara. She's
Right.
In the other room, probably hearing me shout at the top of my lungs. She's in the film. I don't know if you saw her.
Yeah, I did. I did. I also saw Joanna Arno. Yeah.
Yes, Joanna Arno's in it.
What a gem. Yeah.
Yeah, she was great. Dara's great. Yeah, she was good. She plays herself.
She
plays,
sure does.
A programmer, and she did quite well at that.
Yeah, no, that scene was kind of spot on to the, yeah. I mean, the first few of those Q&As I did, those were fun. But then after a while, you're just like, this is the same thing over and over. It's nice to be on stage.
Yeah. It was funny, the Q&As after the, one of our Q&A people, wrote down the very first lines of the film because the film opens with a programmer welcoming filmmakers down. He sort of says like, yes, wonderful, if we could please invite our films. And he for our enjoyment did the exact same thing at our actual Q&A of the film. He sort of walked up to the front and said yes, he wrote it down so he could get it verbatim. And somebody from the audience asked what camera we shot on, and
that won't be the first time that happens.
I don't think so.
No, it's probably going to happen at every single one of your screenings. But you get you probably get the one-on-one Q&A, which is much better than the standing awkwardly Q&A.
It's funny. I was sort of like, I can't wait for this feature film Q&A because it's just going to be me and then, you know, Travis, my co-director,
right.
and we'll have all this time. But actually, we took the opportunity to bring up other people from the team every single screening. So there was like five or six of us, not unlike the images from the movie. So. Yeah, a little kind of like ramped up the potential for awkwardness and, you know, it was less of like a sort of sexy podcast conversation, which is maybe something that I, you know, in my vain dreams imagine. But
you're getting that right now.
Finally.
Yeah, all right. Just let
Thanks,
you know.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, you're welcome, buddy. Oh, that was all you were going to say?
That was all I was going to say. Yeah, we shared the mic and it was a little awkward.
How do your parents feel about all this? How are you with your parents? Do you get along with your parents?
I'm good. My mom was here tonight. She moved to the city a couple of years ago now, so she came up for dinner. I see her quite a bit. She came to the screening.
Very proud.
She was a proud mama.
Yeah.
It's nice to be, you know, cresting into my, I'm 40 now, so it's entering this decade and still have my parents around.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
for see
sure.
What I'm up to, because yeah. I feel like, you know, the older I get, the more cool shit I can be proud of and they can be proud of, and that's nice.
For sure, for sure. When did you turn 40?
I turned 40 in February of this year.
And how did that go? How was that?
It was good. It was uneventful. I had some people saying, you know, what are you going to do? What's your big thing? And we just went to a billiards hall like I do every year. There have been like little moments where I'm like, just truly fleeting moments where I'm like, ah, wish I had this kind of wherewithal at 30.
Yeah.
You know, but... I wish I was premiering my feature film at 30. But I think very, very quickly, thankfully, I realized what an utter waste of time that kind of thinking
yes.
is.
Yes.
And I do manage to push it out.
Because then if you made the feature film at 30, who knows what you'd be doing now?
Right. I might have already burned down.
You could be a janitor.
That's right.
Right. You're not a janitor right now, right?
Not yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not yet. No, I'm not. I'm still sort of just, I'm honestly not far off from where I was when I was 30. I'm still piecing together freelance work.
Yeah,
and,
I remember. I remember that. Remember,
yeah, you know.
That's why
you know
I had to leave. I couldn't do it anymore. Yeah. Although now I miss it, actually. I was talking to somebody who moved from New York recently to Columbus, and he's like, you know, everything in Columbus is just easy. You know, there's nothing that's too heavy. Nothing's a crisis. Everything in New York is some sort of a crisis in one way or another.
Yeah, it's funny how like when you live in New York, you get everything becomes yeah. normalized, and like the absolutely breakneck, insane speed and the madness and the cacophony becomes totally normal. And then when you get out of it for a second, it's like a whiplash.
How do you feel about New York lately? Has it changed a lot? I left there 6-7 years ago now.
I don't know. New York's good. I feel like my network of friends and colleagues and co-creators, etc., is big, and I feel like it's organic. It's taken, you know, I've been here almost 2 decades.
Wow.
And I love these people. I love this place, and I feel like, especially, you know what? It's the making of this feature film has been very affirming because of the number of favors I pulled, or you know, tapping right. into the network, and just sort of like, it was kind of like, oh, I couldn't have done this when I was 30 because I didn't know all these people. I didn't know how to do this.
Yeah, I saw a lot of familiar names. Yeah,
a lot of familiar names. Yeah, both, you know, both literally working on the film, or just sort of like maybe a more implicit feeling of just like empowerment that I can sort of walk around like I belong, like I own the place.
For
like
sure.
I should be allowed to do this.
Yeah.
And that is not something you can rush.
And it's true. For a long time when I was in New York, you don't feel like, it takes a while before you feel like you belong there.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
When it finally hits, it feels oh so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I'm now a New Yorker, or I now at least I'm allowed to take up some space here.
Yeah. The first time you get sort of pissed off at somebody for getting in your way, that's when you're a New Yorker.
Oh, that was like day two for me. So
yeah, I mean, it doesn't take long.
Yeah, yeah,
it doesn't take long.
Now I get frustrated because people walk too slow, because what do you do when you're not I mean, you do the DJing, you do the filmmaking. Are these both things that you can, like, the DJing is a hobby, I imagine?
Yeah, more or less. I get paid, but not enough to live.
Right. It's, right, right,
you know, that they will compensate us for the gigs, but I don't gig nearly enough to pay rent or anything. And the DJs that I know that do that, they actually DJ a lot.
Yeah.
And it's you know, much worse than filmmaking, the sort of like Instagram wish you were there kind of energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's always a cooler party that you weren't at, that you wish you were at, that you did, you know, why wasn't I getting booked there? That kind of stuff's intense. And I'm glad to kind of keep it somewhat at arm's length.
How'd you learn how to do that? Did you just teach yourself?
Yeah, I did. I grew up listening to a lot of rap music, most of it from New York, actually, and not far from where I am now. And I was into like buying records, and I had one turntable, and we would play records and play instrumental tracks and rap over them. That was actually our big impetus for buying records, just because they always had an instrumental. If you bought the single of a song, it had
right,
the instrumental
right.
track. So we would,
yeah.
try and rap yeah. over them, and you know, cosplay white rappers from New Hampshire, and had a great time doing it. And I really loved the genre, and I loved the music. I really loved the music, and sort of started buying more records. Eventually, got a second turntable, and went to college, and started DJing parties, or trying to DJ parties with varying levels of success. And it was there that was also kind of a place where I put in a lot of time, just like hauling gear, setting it up, and then playing these, you know, 6-7 hour parties, trying to figure it out, sort of making lots of mistakes. Right. And that's kind of where I really figured it out and got good enough to feel like when I got to this, to New York, like I wasn't, but I thought I was good enough to play more. And so I kept sort of hustling and eventually found some other like-minded people who were in a similar sort of career point as DJs. And we linked up and made a trio, and we started booking ourselves at these smaller venues, and we would book like a bigger DJ, a more well-known DJ, and then open for them, yeah. You know, play the first couple hours.
Oh, all right.
And that's how we kind of ingratiated ourselves into the scene enough that we were like, finally got booked at a couple of real places. And then we just have sort of clawed, and I wouldn't say clawed our way too, like clawed ourselves in place, I should say, like just to try and maintain the ability to still get booked and maintain relevance, I guess, is sort of the ugly way to say it. That we can still play some places. And then I also got a lot into throwing parties. So now I've gotten really into like...
What's a throwing party?
No, like hosting a party.
Oh, I thought it was a party with people throwing things.
Maybe throwing up, but...
I think it was the way that you said throwing.
Throwing, yeah. I put quite emphasis on
it was
that.
It was a different emphasis, yeah.
Yeah, throwing right. Like, you know, warehouse raves and things like that, have enough of a network of people who like dance music and even people I don't know that we can throw these things and people show up. That's really fun.
I had one record, a 45, that had the instrumental underside. It was the Ghostbusters theme. So I don't know if you're interested in that, but I'm trying to get rid of my vinyl.
Bustin'
so
makes me feel good. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind just popping that in the mail for me, that'd be great.
Bustin' does make me feel good. And you can sing along to it because it's the B-side. It's got the instrumental.
That's right.
Yeah, so big Ghostbusters
I'll have
fan.
To remind me to send you this video, the Bustin' Makes Me Feel Good, like, edit. It's like this weird viral edit of just that part.
Did you ever see the NARM thing that I did years ago from the 6 Feet Under? I never sent you that.
No, send it.
You'd ever see 6 Feet Under the series?
You know, I didn't, and I've heard great things, and it's not for any particular reason. I just never did.
Well, it might be dated now, but yeah, it was a good series. Anyway, since you haven't seen the series, it's pointless to try to describe to you what I did because, yeah, just remixed it in a really bizarre way, and it blew up. It actually became there's a term now, NARM, that refers to what I did.
No kidding.
In like the Urban Dictionary or whatever it is.
How do you spell it?
NARM.
Wow. That's an honor to be in Urban Dictionary.
Yeah, I'm pretty thrilled to be. I mean, my name isn't associated with it,
but
there's a hyperlink to the video, I'm pretty sure, in there.
NARM.
So it's a real honor. It's a real honor.
Wow.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest moments of my life.
I was going to ask you, what's the biggest moment of your life? What's your sort of like big moment that you felt like, wow, this is crazy?
I mean, I've talked about this. This isn't more like this was crazy, but the thing that I think changed my life and profoundly was when I was like in elementary school. I was real young. I went to see a play with I was like going, my sister was a Girl Scout or an Indian princess or whatever, I don't know which, whatever, you know, one of these things, and my mom was the den leader or whatever it is, I don't know, tribe leader, and so I was like just the other kid, so I had to go along with all these events that they would go to, and they went to this play at this local like children's theater, and I was just rapt. I was like, this is amazing, and I convinced my parents to let me go there. And so I took classes at this theater every weekend and was in all the plays. And it just opened me up to a world, you know, growing up in like white suburb America, where football is king and everything else. It just opened me up to a world where there's like working artists and gay people and like, you know, other weird kids like me. And I wouldn't have done art stuff, I don't think, had I not been introduced to that at a young age.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, it was really transformational.
Well, that's a beautiful one. That's like so cinematic.
Yeah. So that was mine.
Yeah. What's number two?
Well, that would be the thing we just talked about, which was the getting on the Urban Dictionary.
Oh yeah.
No, number two would have probably been Sundance. Would be. Number
oh
two.
Yeah, that was. Congrats. Yeah, that was a while ago now.
2011.
2011.
Yeah. Filmmaking's tough though. You know?
Yeah, it's very hard, and that you don't really ever get there.
Yeah, and I haven't made anything since that adults thing, just because like I'm like it takes so much work. to get all the people and the time and the money you need to get. It's not a simple art form to dabble
in. No, you have to really put your whole fucking soul into it.
But like you, what I'd always admired about you is you're so persistent. Like you're always kind of, it always seems like you're making something, like the dollar slice thing, that little documentary you made. Like little things like that, I really always admired that, because you just kind of make these things, these simple things, and then put them out there, and they end up doing well because they're always well made. I didn't see the dollar bus one too, like the dollar bus or whatever.
That's the MO, man. I feel like I'm not necessarily like, you know, I'm not a fucking Spielberg. I'm not like a Picasso, but I can control is perseverance, longevity. You know, I just keep going. Just, I think, like, I tell my students this. I say, listen, talent is such a like a misdirect. There are talented people who do amazing things, but it's not talent that gets you where you want to go. It's persistence. How many times have you been working on something and you hit that first roadblock, that first moment of doubt, and you're like, I should probably stop.
Yep.
This doesn't feel good. I am feeling insecure. I don't think this is going to be good. They're all going to laugh at me. And if you can just keep going beyond that moment and the infinite subsequent moments of the similar feeling, you will make stuff and you will improve and you will have an opportunity to feel successful. And it works.
Right.
It fucking works. Right.
Yeah. As clearly presented here by the feature film. It also makes me think of, like, you know, there's like this mindfulness concept where if you can forget about all the stuff that's happened in your past and stop worrying about what's going to happen in the future, you could literally do anything, because the thing that's holding us back is the memories of our failures and whatever it is in the past that's holding us back. But if you just didn't have that, you could probably do anything.
I feel like I can do anything. I feel like, man, this film, the Dollar Pizza documentary was something that we just manifested into existence. Me and Travis, who's the co-director on Travel Companion. And we, like I told you earlier, those three tenets, like, it's got to be fun, it's got to be honest, and nothing will stop us. That really was, I'm like, that's truly what we said and what we talked about often.
Huh.
It was just,
I
like,
love that. Yeah, I love that.
We're going to manifest. If we just pick a date, it will, you know, if you build it, they will watch it.
Tell me about your collaboration with him. How did you meet him?
We met through Meerkat Media, which is an art collective that we're both in. And we've been friends for, 3-4 years now, maybe something like that. And actually, probably longer at this point, pandemic blur. Anyway, it was Flatbush. So it was around 2020. I was editing that film, and which is a Dollar Van film. And he had just joined the collective. He applied and was selected to join. And I said, I'm looking for some edit help. And he's like, I'm down. And we started working together. And it was just like super smooth. He's just like, he is somebody that I look for in the crowd, because he's really low anxiety.
Oh, that's always
good. He doesn't overthink.
Oh, boy.
But he's very thoughtful. And if, you know, I aspire to be that as much as I can, and to have somebody else who is on that wave is rare. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's like meeting like somebody you want to marry. It's like a creative partner, somebody who's just like, oh shit, we align. You know, we're platonic art buddies, but it's just like, this feels like somebody that I can trust and lean into and take risks with. And when and we know we didn't realize that at first, but we grew it, and we made, he worked on mine, then I worked on his, and then we made something together, and then we made a feature. So it was really just like 1, 2, 3, 4, boom.
That's a wonderful story. It also makes me think that the other thing that really, like, persistence is the big part, but I also think with, like, filmmaking in general, like, meeting people, the people you know, is so much a part of also being successful in that industry. Because, like, when I was in school, like, film school was not so much about, it was certainly about learning how to do the things, but, like, moreover, it was about meeting the people that are going to get you probably jobs or help you out in a project later on in life. Because that happened so many times in New York, at least.
I think so. I think, you know, I talked earlier about, like, leveraging my network and whatever to make this film, but I think it was funny meeting people. One of, I won't say too much because I don't want to add it, but somebody I know, sort of a newer friend of mine, was at Tribeca, and he was like, you know, we were at a party together, and we were standing in the corner kind of just like drinking a beer. And he was like, so should I, like, you know, what do I do? Like, go talk to people? Like, he was kind of very, what's the word? He was feeling very
awkward.
Awkward and just like fish out of water, kind of new.
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say? What is a good word for that? But I can't.
I get
what
it.
And he was sort of just feeling like anxious. And I said, no, dude, you need to just like, you can't rush these things. Like, you just need to have fun, meet people, have a good time. And this was in the context of this party, but it also applies to just like living life and being an artist and making friends. Like, you can't force it. You gotta rush it, and it takes time and it takes dedication. But one day you sort of pause, you look around and you say, wait a minute, I've got a solid crew here. I've got a solid network going here. I can kind of like tap into this. I can both get things from this, and more importantly, I can give things to this. And that is a beautiful thing, and that kind of also ties into my love of New York.
And Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective, like, that was, I miss that quite a bit, just having that community to go see every week, even though it felt like it was kind of, it was on rickety ground when I left, but I feel like it's come back because I've seen, I got the email still.
It's come back around.
Well, it's now the Indonesian gambling company too, right?
That's right. Yeah, I updated that. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's exciting. I'm excited about the new. I mean, it's a real turn.
Well, you got to follow the money, you know?
It's odd to me that an Indonesian gambling site would buy the URL Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective.
I know. We decided to move it to brooklyn.film, and we just let that one lapse. We thought about paying for
it. I see. And then they bought it. Weird.
Yeah, I guess they've been waiting to jump.
But all in all, Alex, like, congrats on all the success, man. It couldn't come to a better person. Like, and the film, it's fantastic. Music's great. I don't know how you got the music, but the music's also solid. The whole vibe thing really all fits together really well. And I hope it gets to be seen at theaters near everybody soon.
Thank you.
Or at least in the independent theaters.
Yes. Yeah. Hopefully we can get a good theatrical distributor and get it out there, and eventually get on streamers and get it seen and make another one. That's the plan.
I would think you'd be able to get, I mean, Tribeca, it seems like, I mean, I don't know how it works anymore.
It's fucked.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any conversations even being had, or is it just like?
Not really. No, we had not so much. I mean, we did, you know, we met some people for sure, but it's not like all the distributors are like so anxious to talk to us. Like, they just can't wait. No, there's not a lot of money for movies without celebrities.
Yeah. Did you meet De Niro?
No, there was a filmmaker brunch that he was at that I didn't go to.
Yeah, that's when we got to meet Robert Redford at Sundance. You get to go up the hill to his little thing, his big lodge, and he comes out looking all weathered and says a few words, and then everybody's like, ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, more or less. That's how it goes down these days.
Well, the last question that I ask people on the podcast, and it sometimes fits, it sometimes doesn't, but I don't really care. What do you think happens when we die, Alex?
Oh.
I know, right?
Nothing.
Really? You think this is it?
Yeah. I think, well, this is it is already sort of a loaded question. If you're asking about like our consciousness, our feeling, our humanness,
whatever the question means to you, Alex.
That, well, I'm telling you what it means to me. Then it ends. Yeah. But is there something larger that we don't understand? Is there something much smaller we don't understand? Without a fucking doubt. And will, you know, does time move forward? Did the other dimensions we can't even comprehend, do they still keep doing their thing and interacting and going upside down? Yeah, for sure. Sure.
Maybe this is just the beginning.
But is it the end of Alex? Definitely. Also, I'd be fine with that.
Well, Alex is a human entity.
Yeah.
But you never know.
As long as the internet's around, my fart NFTs will still outlive me, you know?
If there is a heaven, then I think that God, if anybody, is going to be like, well done with the fart NFTs. That you're in, because that was some solid gold material. That's my God. My God, anyway, is going to be that way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope so. I hope they open up the gates for me.
I think that if you bring the recordings of the fart NFTs and give God a few free ones, I think he'll be. Yeah.
I think he'll
Do
be
I get number 125?
Yeah.
That's God's voice. Yeah. Do I get number 120? Yeah. Like Santa.
he'll get fart number 0420.
Oh, look at you throwing in the 420. It's not even as good as it. But now that it's legal everywhere, it's not nearly as fun as 420 anymore. But I still throw it in there now and again. Does New York City still reek like weed everywhere you go?
Yeah, it does.
They've really done a great job with those illegal weed stores everywhere.
Yeah, they are running wild. Yeah.
I mean, I like weed, don't get me wrong, but Jesus Christ. All right, we get it. That's great. Who knew there was such a demand for this stuff? I mean, come on.
Right?
Alex Malix, thank you for so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to talk to you again. Always good to reconnect. I want to hear what happens with the film and all the things. But yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Jeff. This was a pleasure. It was sort of unexpectedly lovely conversation. I've been doing a lot of film interviews all week, and they're so sort of like short and they're short and sweet, but it's nice to just have a nice conversation with you, and I really enjoyed this.
Take care of yourself, my friend.
All right.
And that was the one and only Alex Malice. Keep up with his film, The Travel Companion, and find out where it's playing at thetravelcompanionfilm.com. You can also learn more about Alex and see some of his other work at his website, alexmalice.com. I'll put both of those links and a few more in the show notes. Thank you to Alex for taking the time to have a conversation on this here podcast. I do appreciate. And thank you to you for listening to our conversation on this here podcast and for listening all the way to the end. I wish I had something exciting to reveal as a reward for you sticking it out until the very end, but I do not. You do have my deep admiration and respect for not being a quitter, and I hope that this outro pleases you in some fundamental way that the people who stopped listening already will never, ever understand. Please like, subscribe, rate, and review, but not necessarily in that order. Any order at all is cool by me. And please pass this podcast along to some other person in your life who you think might enjoy it or get something out of it. Is there an aspiring filmmaker in your family that might enjoy the wisdom of Alex Malice? Or is there an aspiring fart sound seller who might enjoy hearing about his experiences selling fart sounds? There's so much to be gained and so little to be lost. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Now go tell someone you love them. Tell them twice.
Very good, Jeffrey.